So I apologize for the delay in getting here, but if you'd like to call me with any question about the Bible or the Christian faith, our lines are now open. You can call this number, 844-484-5737. Once again, that's 844-484-5737. And you may know I just got back late last night from Cameroon, Africa. I did some live broadcasts last week from Cameroon, though the last several broadcasts I have not been able to do live. Thursday and Friday, I think last week, we were not able to get a good internet connection, so we weren't able to do the program live from Africa those two nights. And then yesterday and the day before, I was traveling. And then I got hooked up a little late today. So I think we're from this point on, I expect things to be about normal, hopefully. And we'll have live broadcasts for the foreseeable future as we normally do. So I apologize for the delay. And if you'd like to be on the program, we have a line open for you at 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is going to be Everett from San Pablo, California. Everett, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, sir. My delight, Steve. Thank you so kindly. My question is two questions. For one is, in St. John chapter 3, Jesus referred to as Moses lifted the serpent, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And then he mentioned right after that, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. So he refers to, it seems like he refers to himself as the Son of Man and the Son of God. Can you tell us the distinctions of these two terms and the purpose of using these two terms?
Well, I can try. Of course, there's many terms and titles for Jesus in the Bible. And Son of God is obviously one of the terms. And Son of Man is actually the one that Jesus used the most when speaking about himself. He called himself Son of Man more than he called himself anything else. But he did not refrain on occasion from referring to himself as the Son of God or a number of other things, the true vine or the, you know, the resurrection of the life, the way, the truth, and the life, the bread of life. I mean, there are all these different terms used of him, and they are also all those are also in the Gospel of John. John the Baptist called him the Lamb of God. All of these expressions are used of Christ. And again, Son of God and Son of Man are among the various titles that are used of him. They're not exactly interchangeable in meaning, but in each way, each title speaks of some aspect of Jesus. Certainly to say he's the Son of God indicates that he was born supernaturally of God. God was his father, and the divine person was manifest in him. That is, God was manifest in the flesh, as it says in 1 Peter 3:15. And so, as Son of God, he is the human manifestation of God. As Son of Man, that emphasizes, I think, the human aspect of that. So, if we say he's this human manifestation of God, Son of God would refer to the latter part, the divine part. Son of Man would emphasize the human part. He is the complete joining of human nature and divine nature, God's nature, in one being. And therefore, he is easily called both titles. Now, the word Son of Man is not really used as a messianic title in the Old Testament, though the expression is found in Daniel chapter 7, I think it's verse 12, if I'm not mistaken. It refers to one like a Son of Man, and it is, in fact, a reference to Christ or his kingdom, though it's not a title. Son of Man is not a title for Christ in the Old Testament. There was in the intertestamental literature a figure that some of the writers called the Son of Man, but these were not inspired writers. And some scholars think that Jesus was trying to identify himself with that Son of Man of the intertestamental writers. I'm not sure if that's what he had in mind or not. In the Old Testament, the term Son of Man simply meant a man. Son of Man was like a son of Adam, a human being, someone who came through the human line. And that Jesus did. He came through the human line. He was not like an angel come down or a theophany. In the Old Testament, God sometimes appeared in a human form, but not through human lineage. He'd just appear and then go away, sort of like it says about Melchizedek. He had neither father or mother, nor beginning of days or end of life. This is a theophany in the Old Testament. It would just appear. It'd be God appearing in a human form, but not as a real human being. because a real human being comes through the family line of Adam. And I think that this term Son of Man emphasizes that he was, in fact, a human. And the term Son of God obviously emphasizes his divine nature. I hope that may help. Let's talk next to Raymond from Seattle, Washington. Raymond, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call, Steve.
Yeah.
Okay, so one question real quick. I know a couple, like maybe 5 or 6 months ago, you were thinking about kicking around an idea of having one particular day of the week where you would actually accept calls of the opposite view, opposing worldview. Did you ever, how's that coming along?
Well, I haven't done it for the simple reason that I don't get enough calls in the course of a month from unbelievers to make me certain that I'd get enough calls to fill a show. You know, I've often thought I'd like to have one day a week where I just say, okay, calls only from non-Christians. And it'd be great. I'd love to have a day like that and full of calls. The thing is, though we do have some non-Christians who call the show, we don't really have so many as to encourage me to think we would fill up a whole show with it. Now, it may be if I had something on the back burner, I could easily say, well, if there's no calls, I'll be interacting with the arguments of Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or something like that to fill in between calls. But I just haven't moved on it because I haven't gotten the impression that we have that many non-Christians who want to call. I'll tell you though, I will encourage them at this point. I know there's people out there not Christian listening. And I would encourage people to call and have a conversation over their viewpoints with me. And if we start getting some, then maybe I will actually assign one day a week for that kind of calls.
Okay. Well, if I could, I'd like to throw one at you. I get this a lot when I talk about the moralistic view of the Christian worldview. This is the one I get a lot. They talk about the big objection they have is Abraham, where God is basically having Abraham sacrifice his son. The moralistic view they're talking about is, how is that a moral test if God is having Abraham sacrifice his son, and if God judges the heart, then by means of Abraham's heart, he's already committed murder already, whether it's irrelevant if it's for God means or not.
Well, I think they got some wrong presuppositions. First of all, it is not wrong for God to authorize a killing. We have, for example, God authorizing the killing of every murderer in the Old Testament and the killing of men, women, and children in Canaan. And, there's a lot of people that God authorized being put to death. God is the author of life. He's the giver of life, and he has every right to take life or to command it to be taken. We don't have that right to do that, unless, of course, God has said, such and such person has to die. But it has to be God. Human beings don't have the right to infringe on the right to life of other human beings. But God says the wages of sin is death, and every human being is a sinner, so God has every right to determine in what way and at what time they will die. And that would include Isaac. Now, of course, God did not really intend for Isaac to be put to death. This was a test of Abraham's loyalty to God, and one of two things would have happened. Either Abraham would have refused, in which case Isaac would live and not be offered, or else Abraham would obey, but God would hinder him from offering Isaac. So, in neither case would Isaac really be offered. Abraham didn't know that, though. Abraham was being tested in terms of his obedience. There was no command in Scripture prior to Abraham's time that says, they shouldn't offer human beings as sacrifice. God probably was alone in knowing that he wasn't going to let him go through with it. But since Abraham lived at a time before any of the laws of God were given, there was nothing, expressly immoral about him obeying God and killing his son any more than if God told Joshua to go kill the children of Canaan. It simply is God who has the right to determine when the sentence on the sinner will be executed. All human beings are sinners, and all are going to die. And God has the right to say when and how. For God to say, okay, Abraham, I want you to offer your son, he's not really saying Isaac's going to die because God's going to prevent that. But he's going to see if Abraham will obey him. People who don't like God are not going to be sympathetic with God's prerogatives. And that's what always turns out to be the case when people are complaining with something God has said or...
And knowing that he wasn't going to let him go through with it. But it says that Abraham lived in fear before any of the laws of God.
Okay, I'm back. My broadcasting unit just got, it just kind of self-destructed, booted itself off the air, and then it rebooted automatically. It's very strange. They're having a little bit of equipment problems here at the moment, apparently. Anyway, I'm not sure really what our issue is here. I can see that the unit is not powering up, so we may have an issue with the battery life on it. Well, we'll just see how this goes. Anyway, I'm sorry. Are you still there?
I sure am.
Okay, my problem with my equipment. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. That's okay. Things happen. It's,
Okay. Well, those who are anti-God are not sympathetic with God's prerogatives, and when God does something they don't like, they often raise that very same kind of complaint you're talking about.
Okay. So their view on the moralistic approach, because I understand, obviously, we're talking about a higher standard of our own, so it's kind of hard to grasp, his idea of judgment, his idea of morals, and, there's many things, and there's tons of passages in the Bible where God does things and implies things for our very own good, even though we don't know about it until hindsight. I guess there's really no real way to argue that point, except they just have to understand that the view is beyond their own understanding.
Well, what they have to believe is that God has the right to give any command he wants to, and he knew that this was going to be a test and that Abraham was not really going to end up killing anybody. So if God wanted to, and God didn't lie to him, God didn't say, I'm going to let you do it. He just told him to do it. So Abraham didn't know that it was not going to go through, but I don't know, it's just... I mean, where's the problem? Where's the problem with God telling a man to do something which God knows he will prevent him from doing? Even if the action would be immoral for us, because we have laws against it, there was no law against it in Abraham's time, so it was not a wrong thing for him to go about seeking to do. To say that God committed, that Abraham committed murder in his heart, he did not commit any murder in his heart. He didn't want to murder his son. He was told by God to sacrifice him. And... so, again, if somebody is sympathetic toward God's prerogatives, they're going to be sympathetic toward God's prerogatives. If they're not, then they're going to put God on the judgment stand and see if he can pass muster to their judgment. That's not really the position they are in. They just think they are. So they're the ones who are really in a strange mental place. Anyone who thinks he can judge God and say what God's allowed to command or what God's not allowed to command is really, really out of touch with reality.
Well, that brings up another interesting point. If you are unwillingly still doing something that is against the law, unwillingly though,
ignorantly,
yeah. What is the comp? What is the? How do you reconcile that? That's interesting. How are you in a judgmental point of view? As far as judgment goes. Go along with something that you don't necessarily, like somebody.
Okay, let's see if we can put this simply. Are you saying, how will you be judged if you do the wrong thing ignorantly?
Right.
Okay, yeah. God will have to assess that. God is certainly not interested in condemning people who are not worthy of condemnation. So he knows if your ignorance is an excuse or not. Some people are willingly ignorant. They have opportunity to know what's right and wrong, but they're not very interested in finding out. And so they end up doing the wrong thing ignorantly, but they should not have been ignorant. God gave them every opportunity to know. In a situation where God has not given you the opportunity to know something, he could hardly judge you for things you did that you thought were right and you didn't know. So, the Bible does indicate that God takes into consideration people's ignorance. Jesus said that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself and did not do the master's will will be beaten with many stripes. But the servant who didn't know his master's will and did things worthy of stripes will be beaten with few stripes. There's obviously a mitigation of the the guilt of somebody who doesn't know they're doing the wrong thing. But there's an awful lot of things we do wrong that we, if we thought about it, we'd realize they aren't really right if we'd listen to our conscience.
Okay. All right. Well, you definitely give it a different, like, I, you know, it's hard for me to translate that. I kind of know what the idea of the Bible is. It's just hard. It's hard to translate that in detail sometimes with weird, unorthodox objections.
Well, there's all kinds of objections out there, and they get repeated over and over again. But there's really none of them that you know, the Bible itself is vulnerable to. It's people who decide that they are in the position to judge God, and that He certainly had better give some good answers if He does things that they object to. Those people are simply too far out of touch with reality. If there's a God at all, then they're not in that position with Him. If there's not a God, then they can't complain about Him. You know, if there's no God, you can't complain about God. If there is a God, then you're not in the position to judge Him. So, I mean, these people are simply not in touch with reality.
That's a good way of looking at it. So if you're objecting, then you're accepting the possibility.
Of course, yeah.
All right, thank you very much for your time, Steve.
Okay, Raymond, thanks for your call. All right, let's talk next to Scott from Roseville, California. Scott, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for broadcasting, Steve. Remember, I had the aneurysm, so the brain is weak, but the soul is getting stronger.
Okay.
And as broadcast earlier in the show, for all of the believers in the Monopoly, our believers that are calling in, remember that they're out in the world, and as charged by Christ, they are to bring in believers and to help them through their struggles so that Satan, the world, or the flesh doesn't get them. So every time you charge a believer, people are going to blame you for having a pastorship, not just a radio show. Thank you, Lord, for you being here.
Yeah, you have a question?
Yes, I do. I was talking to a family member who I love very dearly, but is is a little wayward and would be like you were looking for people to call in that were not already Christian. Well,
yeah.
This would be my family member. And I wanted to share with him the scripture about the definition of love, and I could not find the book, even having been, well, post-aneurysm. I've been through the book three times, cover to cover, Genesis to Revelations, but I could not find the chapter on how long love is long-suffering, how it is.
That's 1 Corinthians 13.
Thank you so much.
Well, you may have had trouble because the term love is not used in the King James Version, but the word charity. If you were looking in the King James Version and looking for the word love, you would not have found 1 Corinthians 13. But
found about 100 listings in the what do you call the thing in the back of the book that tells
the concordance?
Where,
the concordance.
The
yeah.
Concordance. Yeah. I went all the way through the concordance and could not bring it to call, and he didn't want to have a part of it.
Okay.
And he's still steering away from God. But every one of your callers that is Christian that calls in know that they have people in their lives that still need to find their way to God. And any time, like we have fellowship right now, you and I, and all of your listeners listening that believe in Christ, God is there. And so
all right, Scott.
We are the church, and let's go get them.
All right. Thank you, Scott, for your call. It's 1 Corinthians 13 is what you were looking for. Let's talk next to Everett from... Wait, we just talked to Everett. Is he back?
No,
Everett.
I'm back again because the phone had dropped the last time I talked with you. I didn't finish my second question.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Okay,
go ahead.
No problem. When Jesus was in, Jesus had made a statement that Abraham rejoiced to see my day and saw it and was glad. And they asked him, are you greater than our father Abraham? And then Jesus said, before Abraham I was, I am. Can you explain that text to us, please?
He was basically, he said, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day and saw it. They said, you're not yet 50 years old, and when did you see Abraham? This is at the end of John chapter 8. He said, before Abraham was, I am. Now, obviously, the expression, before Abraham was, I am, is strange grammatically, because you would expect, since before Abraham was is speaking of a past time, that he would say, I was. Seems like he'd use the past tense. Instead, he says, before Abraham was, I am, which just makes almost sounds like a grammatical mistake. But he is using a title that God used of himself in the book of Isaiah. Now, many people think that that Jesus is using the title that God used at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. But he doesn't seem to be using that I am, because in the Greek of the Old Testament, the expression Jesus used in the Greek of John does not appear in the Exodus passage. That is, when God at the burning bush says, "Tell them I am that I am has sent you," it does not use the Greek phrase ego eimi, which is what Jesus used in John 8:58. Ego eimi is another way of saying I am. And it's if John or Jesus wanted to connect Jesus' words with the Greek Old Testament at Exodus 3, he would have used the same Greek words that are found there. Instead, he used the same Greek words that are found in a number of passages in the book of Isaiah. And, for example, let me read you a few of them. In Isaiah 43, verse 10, "You are my witnesses, declares the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that I am." Before, or I am he, but in the Greek Old Testament, it's ego eimi. Before me, no God was formed, there shall be none after me. He says in there's another verse here in the same passage, I believe. I am the Lord. Let's see here. Well, we already found it in verse 10. I thought there was another one in the same passage where he speaks about himself. He says, understand that I am. And he then says in chapter 46, there's quite a few of these passages where God speaks about himself as I am he, or I am. Ego eimi can be translated either way. I believe in chapter 46, he said, in verse 4, even to your old age, I am he, and to your gray hairs, I will carry you. Notice, even to your old age, I am he. It's strange that he should have said, I will be, but he didn't say that, because he's actually using a name. I am he is being used as if it is a name. So there's another time I was looking for here, and I thought it was in chapter 43, but I may be mistaken, maybe it's 45, but where God said, before the day was, I am he. Once again, that's the one I was looking for, and I'm not sure really now as I'm glancing through my book of Isaiah. I don't have a concordance here. He said, before the day was, I am he. And that's in the Old Testament. Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am he. You see how the I am he in the Isaiah passages is being used independently of the past or future tense of the sentence. Unto your gray hairs, I am he. You'd expect it to be, unto your gray hairs, I will be. And before the day was, I am he. You'd expect it to be, before the day was, I was. But this is the I am he, the ego eimi in Isaiah, is what Jesus is using, which is a divine title. This is God is using it as if it is a name for himself. And that's what Jesus is using. He's basically saying, I'm the timeless one, basically. I'm not subject to past, present, and future, because I'm God, and God is that way. And so that's, I believe, what Jesus was saying when he used that expression. All right, let's talk to Daniel from Everett, Washington. Daniel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, sir. I got a question. Can you shed some light on tithing? Do we have to pay tithe?
On tithing? You said on tithing?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, I don't believe that the New Testament would place any obligation on Christians to tithe. Tithing is giving 10% of one's increase to the Levites in the temple or the tabernacle in Israel. There's never any other kind of tithing than that commanded in Scripture. When God gave the law of Moses, he set aside one tribe, the Levites, to be full-time in the ministry at the tabernacle, and he told the other 11 tribes that they should give 10% of their increase to the temple to support the Levites. And the Levites, in turn, would take 10% of that and give it to the priests. So this was a system of supporting the tabernacle and its workers. Now, the tabernacle is no longer here, and the tithe is not repeated in the New Testament. Once the temple system became obsolete, apparently the tithe command became obsolete too, because there's no New Testament writer, nor Jesus, who ever commanded his disciples to do it. Now, tithing is mentioned in other places outside the law. For example, Abraham gave a tenth of his war winnings to Melchizedek. We don't know if Melchizedek ever paid tithes ever again after that, but on this one occasion when he was returning from battle with his spoil, he gave a tenth of it to the priest of the Most High God, and we don't have any idea whether that, whether that was a habit for him or not. It certainly doesn't say it was. And it wasn't his increase from produce like the tithe was. It was basically somebody else's money. It was basically winnings from battle. Not typical of the tithing in the Bible, in the law later on. Jacob also promised God that if he would bring him back safely to his father's house after going to Paddan Aram, he'd give God 10% of everything that he got. And we presume he did. But again, we don't read that he did that on a regular basis after that. He might have, but we don't know. There's no command from God that they do that. Both Abraham and Jacob did this voluntarily. And so there was no obligation placed on anyone to tithe until the law came. Now, Jesus mentioned tithing. For example, he mentioned it in Matthew 23:23. But he was speaking to the Pharisees who were under the law and were not his disciples. And he said, you have been negligent in keeping the law in that you've kept part of it, but not the most important part. He said the part you kept was you pay tithes, but you've neglected weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. He says you ought to have done both. Now, in talking to some people who's under the law and saying you've kept part of the law, but not all of it, you should have kept it all, is not the same thing as telling his disciples that they have to keep the law. Because actually they don't. They don't have to, for example, offer animal sacrifices or make pilgrimages to Jerusalem three times a year or do these other things that the law required, nor pay tithes, as far as we can tell. So when churches tell their members that they have to pay tithes, they usually have to appeal to Old Testament passages that require Israel to pay tithes. But on the other hand, if you're going to pay tithes in a biblical way, you're going to have to take 10% and take it to Jerusalem and give it to the temple. But there's no temple in Jerusalem. There's no Levites. There's no one there to do it. I mean, the tithing system went out with the temple system and the Levites. There's never any authorization in the Bible to give your tithes to anyone except the Levites in Jerusalem or at the tabernacle. So we can't do that, and so tithing is not commanded for us in the Bible. Now, some people think that since Malachi chapter 3 says, bring all the tithes into the storehouse so that there might be food in my house, they say the storehouse represents your local church where you go to church. Well, it doesn't. The storehouse doesn't have anything to do with your local church. The storehouse was at the temple, and all the grain for the year was stored up there for the Levites to eat all year long. And the people who grew the grain were supposed to bring it there and put it in the storehouse. Now, the temple where they brought it was not anything like a local church. The local church was much more like the synagogue. The synagogue was much more like the local church. The temple wasn't a local church. It wasn't a place where people went every week or anything like that. It was a place they had to go three times a year for special sacrifices to be offered and so forth. So when it says bring your tithes to the storehouse, it's not talking about the place they went weekly to worship. That would be their synagogue. That would be their local assembly. And they didn't take tithes there, as far as we know. So nothing about Malachi 3 could even by extension relate to bringing the money to your local church specifically. My own thought is that giving should be, not according to some kind of a preset percentage in the New Testament. We are stewards of God's things. Everything we have is the Lord's. And that being so, we need to manage it according to his will. Now, he might tell you to give all of it away. That's what he told the rich young ruler. He didn't say pay your tithes. Almost certainly the rich young ruler had been paying his tithes. He said he'd been keeping the law since his youth. He probably was a tither. Jesus didn't say, okay, you've been tithing to the temple. Now you need to start tithing to my movement, to my church. No, he didn't say that. He said, sell all you have and give it all to the poor. That's not tithing. Jesus said in Luke 14:34, unless you forsake all that you have, you cannot be my disciple. That's not tithing either. What it is that everything we have now belongs to God. We are his slaves. We've been bought with a price. We are not our own. And therefore, the possessions that we once owned before we were Christians now belong to God. And we are now his managers. We manage his goods, and we'll have to give an account for it. Now, everything you have, your house, your car, your computer, your television set, your money, everything you have, it all belongs to God now. And the one concern a Christian has is, what would my master want done with his things? And I will manage them in such a way as one would if they knew that they're going to have to give an account someday for their stewardship. When Jesus returns, he's going to say, okay, what did you do with the stuff I gave you? I didn't give it to you. I left it with you to invest. I left it with you to use for my kingdom's sake. So what have you produced with it? And I'd say that many Christians give less than a tithe to any kind of kingdom work. In fact, we know that. I think somebody did up the statistics. This is somebody who thought they should tithe, but the statistics were put out that I think in America, for example, Christians who go to church, if you average it all out, give less than 3% of their income to the church or to Christian work. That's not very good, because every Christian I know could afford more than 3%. In fact, almost all Christians could afford more than 10%. There are some who can't, but certainly more than 3%. Very few people are so impoverished they couldn't give more than 3% to the work of God. But I'm not telling them how much they should give. I'm not saying you should give 10% or 15 or 20 or 5 or whatever. I mean, it's not my business how you steward God's stuff, but it's his business, and you'll give an account to him for it. If you don't believe that, that may not put the fear of God in you. If you do believe it, it should make you very careful about how you're using the resources that God has put in your hands, because he will say, okay, I gave you X amount. How much could that have produced for me if you invested it well for me in my kingdom? How much did you actually invest? How much did you actually produce? I think that when you really take that seriously, you'll realize that giving 10% is pretty tawdry for most Christians. I myself am not a rich man and never have been, but I've always given more than 10%, because I've never felt that 10% was really a worthy amount to be giving to, you know, support missionaries and church and so forth. I think much more should be given. And most Christians, including poor ones like I've been, I'm not so poor right now, but I was really poor during much of my adult life, probably 30 or 40 years of it. I was quite poor. But I still gave at least 20%, and in the years since then, I've increased that amount, because I don't consider that 10% is really a respectable amount to be giving to the kingdom of God when God has given you enough to live on and more. So those are my thoughts on it. There's nothing in the Bible, in the New Testament, that would impose tithing on Christians, but I think most Christians should be given a lot more than that. All right, I appreciate your call, Daniel. All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have about 10, 12 more minutes, and we have no calls waiting. So I think my equipment's going to hold up. I can't really guarantee it, but I think it's going to hold up the rest of the show. And if you'd like to give me a call, you can reach me right now at 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And give me a call now, and you'll get right through, and we can talk. And if you don't give me a call now, we might not get you through at all, because the show is going to be over in not so very long from now, 10 minutes, I'd say. I got this email from Chris in Colorado. Steve, in reading the account from Acts 5, 1 through 11 about Ananias and Sapphira, the part that I have trouble understanding and that I think unbelievers may find to be unbelievable is that somehow Ananias dies and was buried, apparently with no knowledge or involvement of his wife Sapphira, as she was confronted by Peter about 3 hours later. This seems strange to me. I would think that somehow, some way, this knowledge would have come to her, and she would have been involved in the process. Your thoughts? Well, the problem here is that we're told that Ananias and Sapphira conspired together to cheat God, and Ananias was confronted about it without his wife present, and he dropped dead. He dropped dead because, I guess God struck him. And he was taken out and buried. And a few hours later, his wife comes in, not knowing about it, and she also is confronted and asked about the matter, and she lies, and she drops dead. Now, the question is, how could she be unaware that her husband had died 3 hours earlier? It would have been a shock that went through the church. How could she not have heard of it? Well, I don't know. But in other words, frankly, there's no reason why the writer of Acts would lie about that, make that up. He could have had her come in, 10 minutes later, if it would seem more realistic, or whatever. But, he tells the story as it happened, so he gives his 3 hours. I suspect that Sapphira might have been, doing something out of touch with the church for those 3 hours. Maybe she was visiting someone. They didn't have, they couldn't text each other or tweet about it. News would have to get around. Maybe she was out of town and just got back. And it's very possible that Peter, wanting to test her loyalty or her honesty, as he did Ananias, may have informed the church, don't tell her about this. Let me talk to her. And so it may be that, she saw some Christians coming in who knew, but they were mum about it. This was something that she was going to have to be tested about. And so Peter might have just told people in her absence, don't tell her. I don't know. I honestly don't know what happened. But it's not impossible to imagine scenarios where she would not have heard of it. We just don't know what the background scenario was. All we know is that it happened the way it's reported. Let's talk to Jacqueline from Port Townsend, Washington. Jacqueline, welcome. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is not, essentially I'm engaged to be married, and I...
Congratulations.
Thank you. I was looking through, reading my Bible, and I think it was in Matthew, I don't know what chapter, but it's where the Beatitudes are being spoken of, and where she talks about Beatitudes. And there's a portion that talks about adultery and having a woman being divorced, basically some laws around if a man is not pleased, he gives her a note, he takes walked away from the household,
right?
But it would be adultery if she wouldn't remarry. And I've been married before, so I'm kind of, and then it referred me somewhere, I think it was in Deuteronomy, that talks about the law more specifically, basically that the woman, if asked to leave, if divorced by the husband, was given...
Why don't you tell me something about how your divorce took place? Did you divorce your husband?
Let's see. Well, it was mutual, actually. So it was mutual. We both agreed.
Were you a Christian at the time? Were you a Christian at the time?
It's being baptized and accepting Jesus into my life. Yes, I was. As far as living, what I committed myself to? No. That's how I see it now.
Neither of you had committed adultery? As a basis for the divorce? Okay.
No.
Since your divorce, has your husband remarried?
Yes.
Okay, let me tell you what I understand to be the case.
Okay.
I know the passage in Matthew 5:32 that you're referring to, and Jesus repeated it in Matthew 19:9. Now, I just need to give you this as a disclaimer. My position on this is not held by all Christians, not even all Christians who believe the Bible interpret it the same. There are a handful of New Testament texts that talk about divorce and implications about remarriage. They don't all read exactly alike, and so different people have speculated or analyzed these texts and reached different conclusions. I think the majority of evangelicals see it similarly to the way I do. But that doesn't mean it's true. It just, my view, I reach not by following the majority of evangelicals, but following my own understanding of Scripture as I study it. But there are people who study it and reach other conclusions. And the reason I give you this is because I believe that you probably are free to remarry at this point under the conditions spoken of. Jesus said, if a man divorces his wife except for the cause of fornication and marries another, he commits adultery. And he that marries the woman so divorced also commits adultery. Now, what Jesus seems to be saying is divorce, remarriage is forbidden unless the marriage has been ended by fornication. That is, one person has slept with somebody else or is doing so. And now, in the case of your divorce was wrongful because neither of you had slept with anybody else, and therefore it was a sin to divorce. But in the time since then, your husband has remarried. That means he slept with somebody else, assuming he's not in a celibate marriage. So that would mean then that he, by remarrying, has broken the vows he made to you. And therefore, if you were not currently divorced, you would have grounds for divorce now because of that. But you are currently divorced, and he has done that. So, I mean, it's a moot point. You don't have to go to court and get a divorce when you're already divorced. But I believe that his going forward into another relationship has broken the relationship that you had with him to the point where you are now free to remarry. Not everyone would agree with that, but I do. And I've done a lot of study on it. And I would recommend, if you're interested in analyzing all the relevant passages, I have written a set of three articles that exist as one file at my website called Divorce and Remarriage. And I analyze all the verses in the Bible, I think, that have any reference to this. And and so it's at my website. If you go to thenarrowpath.com and at thenarrowpath.com, hit the tab that says topical articles. These articles appeared in a magazine some years ago. And there were three installments, but they're all in one article now at the website. Just look up topical articles and go to Divorce and Remarriage, and you'll read what I consider to be a sound analysis of all the biblical teaching on that.
Fantastic. That's great. Well, thank you so much for hearing that concern. I felt concerned.
Like, all right, Jacqueline.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
I appreciate your call. God bless you. All right, our next caller is Curtis from Lodi, California. Curtis, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is in Revelation chapter 13, verses 16 and 17, pertaining to the mark of the beast and being able to buy and sell. I take that literal, exactly what it says. I would like to get your point of view on that.
All right. I'm putting you on hold because there's a ton of background noise on your phone. So I've got you on hold now, so we don't have to listen to that noise. The mark of the beast has been interpreted a lot of different ways, but I take it to be something of a, I think it's symbolic, so I don't take it literally. I don't believe that everybody's going to have the number 666 stamped on their forehead or on their hand. Now, many people who think they take it literally don't believe that either. They believe there's going to be a computer chip under the skin. And it won't be the number 666. It'll be their social security number or some other kind of identification number, and that you won't be able to buy or sell because they'll be living in a cashless economy where you use this number as sort of a credit number. And so people will not be able to buy or sell because stores won't take money. They'll have to take the number. And if you don't have the number, you can't buy or sell. This is how many people understand it. Well, I don't know. Those who say they take it literally and who think that, they're not taking it literally because, of course, the Bible doesn't say anything about a chip under the skin. And it doesn't say anything about a credit number. It says about the mark of the beast or the number of his name. And his name is numbered 666. So if we're talking literally, everybody's going to get marked, not inserted under the skin, but marked with a number. And it's the same number on everybody, 666. There's not different numbers for different people. Now, I understand the number 666 simply to refer to the name of the beast in John's day, who I think was Caesar Nero. And I believe that taking his mark on your hand or your forehead simply speaks about being a slave of the system, because they used to tattoo slaves on their forehead or on their hands in the Roman Empire. And I think that the readers of John's writing there would understand that. And we recognize he's saying these people have the brand of the devil's system on them. They are slaves of that system. In the next verse after that, in chapter 14, verse 1, there's people who have God's name on their forehead. If you notice that, chapter 14, verse 1 talks about people who have God's name on their forehead. Well, God's people don't have his name literally on their forehead. They are slaves of God. So it's as if they have his brand on their forehead. They're contrasted with those who have the devil's brand. So everyone's either a slave of God or a slave of the devil and his system. And I think the imagery there is of that, having the tattoo or the brand of your master upon you. Not that it's a literal thing. The real mark of being a follower of Jesus or a follower of the devil is in your actions. And therefore, I think when people are not able to buy or sell. I think it's talking about being persecuted, boycotted, as has happened many times in many countries. Christians have not been able to buy or sell because people wouldn't do business with them. The Nazis did that with the Jews in World War II times. They wouldn't do business with them. And there's been many times in history this has happened to Christians as well because of persecution. I wish I could go into this more, but my teachings on Revelation at my website do, and you can listen to those for free at thenarrowpath.com. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website, though everything there is free. It's thenarrowpath.com. Again, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.